When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast. My name is Chris Hurst. We've been working away behind the scenes to bring you season 3, and I have an amazing lineup of guests in the pipeline, including former White House Director of Communications Anthony Scaramucci and the editor of the Financial Times, Rula Khalaf. Season 3 will be dropping in the next few weeks, and I'll be sure to keep you all posted. But I wanted to bring you today's episode a little sooner. Last Thursday, I had the privilege of speaking to the BBC's World Affairs editor, John Simpson. Back in late January, when John agreed to come on the podcast, I thought we'd be discussing the many and varied global leaders he has met and interviewed through his long career, rather than the biggest conflict in Europe since the Second World War. When I caught up with John, he had just returned from Finland, where he was reporting on the Ukraine crisis for his new BBC programme, Unspun World, and was hoping to get out to Ukraine itself as soon as possible. John has dedicated his life to reporting from the front line, joining the BBC more than 50 years ago as a reporter. His eyewitness testimony has shed light on many of the most significant moments in modern history, from the fall of the Berlin Wall to the Iraq War in 2003, where he was seriously injured in a friendly fire incident on the road to Baghdad. His career has taken him to more than 120 countries, including 30 war zones. We had a fascinating conversation about all of that, but had to begin with the events of the last 3 weeks. And I started by asking him whether Russia's invasion of Ukraine was a unique moment of crisis in his career.
Yeah, pretty much, actually, because, you know, you have to be even older than I am to remember when one country just marches into its neighbor and takes it over. Actually, of course, the Russians have got previous in this as well as so much else. I mean, they did march into Hungary in 1956 and into Czechoslovakia, as it then was, in 1968. And of course, into Afghanistan in 1979, but that was a slightly different operation. So it's not true, therefore, to say it hasn't happened in Europe in my lifetime. It hasn't happened like this in Europe in my lifetime. The idea of just simply sending in your tanks and some very nasty other types of weapon and using them fairly indiscriminately against ordinary civilians. I mean, we've seen examples of that just even overnight up this morning. So, yeah, it's different. It seems different. And it's, I'm afraid, brought an end to that feeling which most of us had that things were kind of getting better. They've got very, very much worse now.
And you've touched on this in your answer to that question, but there were many warning voices in the run-up to the invasion. But at the same time, I feel like many people, and I think including many world leaders, couldn't really believe that he'd do it. Did you?
No. I didn't. I'll be absolutely honest. I thought that the intelligence that we were getting out of London and Washington was a kind of wind-up to make sure that Putin was nervous and would step back from anything he was going to do. I didn't think that the intelligence was so accurate, so moment by moment accurate. And I didn't think Putin would be so stupid, actually. He's a very clever man. I've met him. I've been hugely impressed by him. But, You know, there's one criminologist that I know said he really did just lock himself up over COVID and saw scarcely anybody. And, you know, I think these feelings of anger towards Ukraine simply welled up inside him until it did happen.
So do you think then that where we are now can be considered a failure of leadership by the West particularly? Or given that Kremlinologist's observation, do you feel like this was a sort of, the trajectory was inevitable, that he was going to do this almost whatever happened?
Well, I'm not sure about how inevitable it was, but I don't believe that it was a particular failure of the West. I mean, the West has failed in all sorts of ways in the run-up to this crisis. I mean, countries do, people do, individuals do. But I don't think it was a kind of clear-cut action or lack of action by the West that did it. I mean, you could say, for instance, that Joe Biden pulling American and therefore other Western troops out of Afghanistan last August was a suggestion to Putin that he was weak and that the West wouldn't come together. I mean, that's perfectly possible. Yeah. Anybody who looked at the way that Germany has behaved in the past over the Nord Stream pipeline, for instance, would say they'll never do anything. You know, they'll always just sit there and take whatever we do. But that was a really serious failure on Putin's part. I don't think it was so much a failure on the West's part. I think it was a failure of interpretation on his part.
I think in some ways, I feel like that the West has been as shocked by the coherence of the Western response, possibly, as Putin has been.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, all the signs were that we'd all sort of go running in different directions right up until the moment where it became clear that Putin was actually going to do it. You know, there was France. I mean, how long ago is it since Macron said that NATO was brain dead? It's probably about three months, something like that. You know, Germany brings in a left of center chancellor. Anybody would think he'll probably follow the sort of Gerhard Schröder line from the past and will want to keep in with the Russians. And bingo, directly the flag was up. There was Germany taking an extraordinarily tough and strong line. And there was Macron sharing all his information with the West. I mean, when did that happen? And acting as though he was a member of this team that suddenly didn't seem to be brain dead any longer.
It's interesting you mention Schultz. It strikes me that everything that we're talking about is very speculative, but it strikes me that it would be at least possible that Putin would calculate that he would come in at least initially in a relatively weaker position than Angela Merkel as a new leader. She, you know, seen as this kind of icon for more than a decade. But it strikes me that actually, because he was so new into that role, it was easier for him to make that huge policy U-turn than it might have been for Merkel, who was freighted with that 12-year strategy, which had been hers up until that point.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. It would have been really almost impossible, I think, for her to have, for instance, jacked up Germany's defense spending in a matter of weeks. But you know, Scholz is a social democrat. It's not very easy for him to just ignore the mutterings on the left of his party and do these things that, you know, we might have expected, we might have associated more with a Christian democratic leader.
Mm. So Putin's been an unchallenged leader of in Russia for more than 20 years. Obviously, there was that slightly odd interregnum when Medvedev, I think it was, sort of took charge. Do you think that, I mean, you mentioned the last 2 years of the isolation of COVID, but do you think that sort of a key to understanding him now is understanding that he's been essentially, I suppose, on a trajectory to being a dictator for the past 20 years?
Well, all I can tell you is that I've watched Putin over the years, over those 22 years, and longer, actually. I first met him about a month after he became the deputy mayor or a deputy mayor of St. Petersburg.
Which was in 1992.
And I was introduced to him by the actual mayor, Anatoly Sobchak. And I just have a little faint sense of a short, ginger-haired, rather kind of inward-looking a figure whom I tried to be polite to, but was probably rather dismissive of, because he clearly didn't count and he clearly would never go anywhere.
Yeah.
I've met him, talked to him privately and publicly over the years. And I would never have thought that he would turn into this kind of character. He was obviously a very kind of suspicious and careful character. I mean, there wasn't anything very sort of open and pleasant about, except I have to say, at the risk of sounding, name-dropping outrageously and so on, he did say nice things about my broadcasting and ironically, even more ironically, said very nice things about the BBC, to which he listened, he said, on a daily basis to improve his English. And, you know, the same man would not say or do those things. Now, something has happened in the meantime. Has the power just simply gradually over the years gone to his head? It certainly has gone to his head. But is it more recent?
So I really want to talk about the rest of your career. I'm going to leave Ukraine in a minute, but I feel like on a podcast about leadership, we cannot leave Ukraine without talking about its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, who it seems to me is, well, I'm not just me. I think the world, it seems like he's an absolutely astonishing man who I genuinely believe, personally, I believe he's already left an indelible mark on history, irrespective of how this plays out. I think a case of cometh the hour, cometh the man, if ever there was one. Have you met him or what are your impressions?
I haven't met him. I hope I'll do so in the next sort of month or so. I mean, again, confession time. When I saw that a comedian was standing for the presidency and then that against the run of play, he had won the presidency. I'm afraid I thought, you know, this is the world in general. This is kind of going down the tube really, really fast.
Yes.
And what a magnificent performance that he's put up. I mean, that I don't think any of the MPs and Lords in the Commons and the House of Lords who watched him the other day will ever forget that experience as he sat there in his dirty overalls and he hadn't shaved for a bit, showed them what actual leadership can really, really be like.
Yes, I mean, that is going to be is already a historic moment that we'll talk about, I'm sure, for way beyond our lifetimes, I think, that speech. So, look, John, I honestly could talk to you about Ukraine forever, but you've done so many other fascinating things as well. So let's move on to your career prior to the last 2 weeks, essentially. we're going to move from one, let's say, dubious leader to some others. You once specialised in interviewing dictators such as Saddam Hussein, Colonel Gaddafi. How did you prepare for these? Was it different to meeting, François Mitterrand? In terms of your preparation, I'm sure the experience was different.
It is, because for one very good reason that ordinary politicians, or at least elected politicians, they're used to answering questions. Dictators aren't. Dictators don't actually like being asked questions. When you asked Saddam Hussein a question, he'd rear up and look at you as though, who are you? What brings you here? You know, you are just simply my mouthpiece, the loudspeaker that I'm shouting into. You know, you don't get to ask me questions. And that is true, I think, of all the various dictators and weirdos that I've interviewed. And even the most, what should we say, I'm just trying to think about it, of a suitable and inoffensive expression to describe Margaret Thatcher. I mean, she was deeply autocratic in many, many ways, but she would listen to your questions and she would answer, well, often I used to think, give you a better answer than most other politicians, you know, who turn up with it all prepared and practiced in their minds.
So she took you seriously.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how seriously she did take.
She pretended to take you seriously.
BBC journalist, but she listened to the question. She liked being asked difficult questions. I suppose that's it. She liked showing off, and she loved it when she actually used to really enjoy it when I would try and find really kind of complicated ways of getting her to confess that she was wrong and about something. And the way in which she dealt with that, I used to think was a masterclass in interviewing. But that's the big difference. I mean, there's another difference that you're always with a man like Colonel Gaddafi, for instance, but there's loads and loads more. The Emperor Bokassa of the Central African Empire, no less, one of the two emperors that I've interviewed in my time. You never knew really whether if you actually pushed them beyond a certain limit, you might not leave, well, even the room, let alone the country.
Well, that was good. That was my follow-up question: is were you scared or scarred by any of those experiences?
Unscarred, I think, unscarred by most things. Well, that's good from having a deeply insensitive nature, really. But unscarred by physically. I mean, no, I never was beaten up or roughed up, I think, as a result of any interview, except one, but that was the IRA, and that was a long time ago. Wow. But I mean, in terms of going to, you know, to Baghdad or something, you knew pretty much actually that you were going to get out of there okay.
And who was the most memorable leader that you've met?
Well, memorable for different lots of different reasons. I mean, I suppose it's a bit of a kind of Reader's Digest answer, but I suppose I've got to say Nelson Mandela, because you couldn't keep your eyes off him. I mean, he had that fantastic star quality where even just standing up and picking up his walking stick was done like a star. And he was so genuinely charming. He was as real in private and before he became president as he was after his presidency. And I loved him. I absolutely loved him. He wasn't perfect, and he made, you can say that he opened the door a little bit to the corruption that's just overwhelming South Africa now, but in terms of the person that he was, just quite magnificent. Václav Havel of the Czech Republic, a man that I got to know when he was a political fugitive, well, not a fugitive, but an ex-prisoner, just been allowed out, ill, in quite seriously ill from the way that the Czech authorities had treated him.
And so when is this? Is this the 1970s?
No, this was 1983, I think. I went there, you know, what a fantastically brave and charming and funny man he was. Again, you know, if you were building a political leader out of Lego or something, you know, he is the one that you would want. He understood ordinary people. The first thing he did when he got into the this enormous palace, the Hradčany Palace in Prague, was to order a couple of scooters so that he and his chief advisor could go down the corridors, up and down the corridors, talking to each other as they scooted. There wasn't anything that man did that seemed to me wasn't absolutely what a decent and wonderful political leader should do. So there's them. I mean, there are loads of others, but those are the two best ones, the ones that I loved, actually, not just liked, but loved.
It's often said that journalists write the first draft of history. And I think in that way, that is a leadership responsibility, let's say. Do you feel like that weighs on you a little?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, aside from my day job, I've written various books, some of them about journalism, and looking back at, in one case, looking back at journalism right back to its very origins in the 1620s, and I've been often very critical of British and other journalists for the way in which they've been taken in, the way in which they allowed their own preconceptions to colour everything. I mean, please do not read the British press on the Russian Revolution, because you'll scarcely get a single genuine fact out of it. But that means, of course, that does weigh on me a bit. You know, am I doing the same kind of things that the British press did then, or that they did, I don't know, the time of Suez or something? Am I allowing my ideas, my principles, my affections often to cloud my judgment of what's going on here? I mean, journalism is such an inconsistent and unreliable guide to things. The fact is, it's the only guide we actually have to daily.
Well, I was going to say, it's the best we've got,
it's
right?
It's the only thing we've got,
It's certainly, in my opinion, preferable to getting your worldview from Twitter, for example.
Don't talk to me about Twitter. I mean, I fling my phone across the room every now and then with the stuff that people write.
Yeah, you and me both. But building on that, do you think that you've got things wrong? And indeed, is it that even the right word to use in the context of journalism and your
role? I think it's got to be, because if you don't hold people like me to account for what we've written, then, you know, what's the point of anything? Yeah, I've got loads of things wrong in my time. I think remember every example or most of them. I mean, these are usually quite trivial things. There have been bigger things, and as I say, fortunately I didn't do any broadcasting about whether Putin was liable to invade Ukraine. But if I had, I would have got that very, very badly wrong. And I'm so glad that fate just held me back from doing it, and there were lots of other things to talk about which were slightly safer. But yeah, I mean, I didn't know that Saddam Hussein would invade Kuwait. Well, that's not a good example, because nobody else did either.
No,
that was just his decision overnight. So many things that I've failed at.
And so impartiality is a hot topic at the BBC right now. And by the way, I'm not going to get you into any trouble, I hope. What does that mean to you? I mean, do you ever feel kind of caught in the middle?
Well, yes. I mean, I think you should be too. I think you should always feel that you are. And I mean, I'm not evading your question because I will come and answer it. But I always think the right place for a journalist is in the kind of no man's land between the different sides. I get really uncomfortable about the idea of, for instance, talking about we, us, our. That
yes.
I don't feel happy talking about that, whether it's about Britain or about the West or even indeed about human beings, although I suppose it's more acceptable if you're talking about the human race in general. To be unbiased, to be honest, to be open is, I think, the right way of doing things. If you can do it, I think you have to accept it's bloody difficult. To take off your carapace of opinions and background and so on and see things as they are. But I think it is possible. I would argue that it's entirely possible and should be done. What I don't think works any longer is how the BBC used to do things. You know, the government says this, the opposition says that, and you just leave it there. I don't think that's any longer really acceptable. And the judgment that, say, a government minister has said something which isn't true, this is very much of our time. That it's, you know, because government ministers used to strive very hard not to tell lies in public.
How old-fashioned.
I know, and how depressing that it should be.
Yes.
I think that a balanced broadcaster has to take account of untruths. And has to redress the balance for the untruths, as well as it's just such a cop out to say, the Remainers say this and the Leavers say that. It's, you know, you just might as well not exercise a brain at all. You could just put their handouts side by side and read them out. So I think that I'd die for the principle of balance. I think it's the most important thing that the BBC can do and has ever done. Do we get it wrong? Of course we do. Loads of times. I got it wrong loads and loads of times. I'm not saying we do it right, but I'm saying that striving for it is the most important thing we can do.
Yes, and I think particularly we just mentioned Twitter, in a world where if you want to know what the left say or the right say or the Remain say or the Leave say, you can find that everywhere all the time. If you just, mouthpieces exist in a way that they didn't, I think, in the past. Mm. So in a sense, the role of the media was partly to tell you what each side were saying, whereas it seems to me now that the role of journalism, and certainly when people are paying for journalism, and I mean, we are paying for the BBC in an indirect way, well, in a direct way, just in a different way. I think the role of journalism has evolved in that sense as well, as you want journalists who are going to interpret what is being said and what is happening. And I think that's, for me, that role is even more important when we're being deluged with this kind of, the social media or the Twitter channels from the opposing forces.
Yes, no, I thoroughly agree. I think this principle of the license fee, I think, should be something which hangs over everybody that works for the BBC. And you know, I think you should be able to say to yourself, when I'm reporting on this particular situation, whatever it may be, I'm reporting to people who've got very, very different, probably opposing views of what's going on. And not that you can necessarily convince them, but the one thing that you do have to convince them about is that you're being honest and fair and that you're saying these things because you have evidence to believe they're true. And that, I think, is what differentiates public service broadcasting. It's not only the BBC from other forms of journalism. You know, it isn't. We aren't just the same as the Daily Mail or the Daily Telegraph or the just working in a different medium. It's a different mindset, and I think that is really important, actually.
And it's interesting as well. We talked about Ukraine. Suddenly, we find ourselves in a world where there's a war again in Europe. And I think that we might find ourselves being reminded about the BBC's role beyond the UK. You know, the BBC historically has been a source of reliable information for people in all sorts of oppressed and difficult situations. And I think we to an extent sort of forgot that a little bit. And I think that's possibly going to become more important again in the future.
Well, I hope you're right. Listenership to BBC Russian service on the radio tripled virtually overnight when the invasion of Ukraine happened. You know, this year, I'm sorry, I'm beginning to sound like a bit.
No,
of
no, I ask you. I'm a supporter of the BBC, so I'm a big fan. So no problem.
Well, thank you. We're now going to hit at some stage this year, probably quite soon, 500 million viewers, listeners, and readers around the world. Half a billion people. It's biggest audience of any organization broadcasting abroad, and an opinion poll, the independent opinion poll just recently showed that the BBC was the most trusted broadcaster of any internationally. And these are things, you know, they're great, but of course you can't just sit back and say, oh, well, that's fine, you know, that's where you've got to keep on working for it and to make sure that in a year's time, in 2 years' time, people are still saying the same thing.
Mm. I want to come back and talk specifically a bit about your job as a correspondent. What does it involve? I mean, obviously, what I imagine is the tip of the iceberg bits where, you know, you talk to Vladimir Putin or, you know, Angela Merkel or whoever it is. But I imagine that the vast majority of your job isn't doing that.
No, I mean, to be honest, and I'm perhaps being more than honest than I should be, for some time I was kind of pretty much hanging on the precipice. I mean, I'm now 77, there was a definite kind of move to say, you know, cut the old boy loose, which I rather resisted. In the last 2 years, year or 2 years, I've kind of made a comeback. I've got a son, 16 years old, lovely boy, not perhaps as well read in the classics as he might be.
That's true of us all. That's surely true of us all, John. Certainly true of me.
A great lover of football. And I said to him, when the BBC's now given me a new programme and a lot more opportunities to travel and broadcast, bless their hearts. And I said to my son, I feel exactly like Lazarus. And my son said, oh, yeah, who does he play for?
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. So do you think that people that report from war zones are a particular breed? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, people you will know far better than me, but, you know, Kappa and Gellhorn and Ernie Pyle and, you know, your colleagues, Martin Bell and Lise Doucette. You don't seem to fit the stereotype. Do you think there is one?
There is a stereotype, which is, you know, those characters that go around with those jerkins with all sorts of pockets and stuff like that, and silly hats, and say, you know, where's the front line? I mean, that is there are types like that. They tend not to be from the big organizations. They tend to be kind of freelancers who turn up, and bless their hearts, they often do a superb job, but not my kind of not the kind of person I kind of identify with, really. I think the one thing that does seem to link all these people together is a willingness from time to time to set aside their own particular comfort and safety, and secondly, a real sense of curiosity about what's happening, an unwillingness just simply to take it off the front page of The Guardian, and a desire to go and see for themselves what's actually happening. And that is true of just about everybody that you've named. I mean, Martha Gellhorn, I'm proud and grateful to say, was a real close friend of mine in the last, what, about 6 years, I think, of her life in London. And I had hours upon
hours. She must have had some amazing stories.
Oh, fantastic. Sorry, I'm funny stories and savage stories, and not always very comfortable stories either. And, you know, I mean, her first husband, Ernest Hemingway, wasn't exactly one of her favourites either. And that whole idea of that male type of journalism, she didn't like that. But she didn't like, funnily enough, she didn't like all this emphasis on women journalists either. She said, "Darling, I'm just a journalist. I happen to be a woman. It's of no significance." And so she, you know, not very enthusiastic about a lot of the things in our professional lives now.
I wonder to myself whether you've been a little bit self-effacing, in the sense that one of the things we haven't talked about is raw physical courage. I mean, does that play a part?
Well, I mean, if I'm honest, yes, it does. It can do, at any rate. The first thing to say is that even reporting in war zones right up on the firing line is not often as dangerous, or it's not 100% dangerous all the time. I mean, I've had various, got various injuries, bit lumps of metal in me, limp, deaf, all from bombs and guns and things. But those things usually happen not because you've pushed ahead somewhere you shouldn't be, but by chance somebody else has made a mistake in where you're bombed. I think the one thing that if I were talking to a young journalist who wanted to do these kind of things, I would say always go further than you think you ought to, because your fears kick in quite early on when you're going around, and there are loud bangs and you know, all sorts of things happening. You should get closer. Always get closer, and I've passed that on to people. In my own case, I think if I can be if I can stand outside myself a little bit, I think the times that I have some reason to be proudest of is not those necessarily those times. It's when you're on your own, and your organization orders you to leave. And on, I think, three occasions, I've disobeyed instructions and stayed. And it was always the right thing to do. I mean, once when a group of people were hunting us down in Serbia during the bombing of Belgrade, and once in the bombing of Baghdad in 1991. Again, the BBC ordered me out, and somewhere else too. And I just think there are times when you've got to say to yourself, look, I'm probably not going to get out of this, so I'm going to do the best I possibly can while I'm here. And then bingo, you do get out of it. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's win-win.
it sounds absolutely terrifying to me, I'm going to be honest, John. For somebody who works in advertising, that's pretty scary. What's kept you going? What's kept you going back to do all these places over the past 50 years? I mean, are you a little bit of a secret adrenaline junkie? I mean,
No, I'm not. I really, really am not. Honestly, I'm not. I just kind of get irritated that I'm not seeing it for myself, really. That's all. I mean, I'm having no secret, I think, about it. I'm having a real battle with the BBC at the moment because I very, very much want to go to Ukraine. And they look at me and they think, this old boy is 77 and, he's probably not going to make it. And so we're having a battle. I suppose they'll win, but
you might have to end up being one of those guys you were talking about. You might have to get your jacket with lots of pockets on and just go yourself.
Myself. Yeah, but I'm too mean to pay for myself after 50 years of being paid for. So I mean that's really what keeps me going. I think it is to have something to add to the general conversation about a situation like this. I belong nowadays. I often think I'll get into trouble for belonging to the Garrick Club. In trouble because, you know, it hasn't yet accepted women, though it will, of course. When I first started as a member, lots and lots of famous old broadcasting luminaries like Robin Day and, endless others used to have a table in the dining room, and they'd sit there, and if you sat near them, you'd hear all their old stories. But the stories all ended on the day they retired. Yeah. And I just used to think, I really don't want to be like this. I don't want my life to end at the age of 68. And then suddenly the only people I can talk to or are interested to talk to me are people who remember all those things from the past. I don't want to be, I probably am anyway, but I don't really want to be the club
I'm
boy.
Sure, I'm sure that'll never happen. So I have two final questions. The first is, if you could go back to the start of your career, what advice would you give your younger self?
Never, ever leave a story. I was in Angola, and I stumbled together with several other people. I stumbled across a really big story at the time, a massacre that had been carried out by British soldiers, British mercenaries rather, and it was ultra scary. It really was absolutely terrifying. And the BBC said, come back to London and do it. And I went back to London. And the people that I'd left behind got the story out before me and got a much better and more effective story than I did. I would say to any young reporter, never, never leave the story until you're absolutely certain that it's finished. And do not go out early because you're scared, because you'll always be scared about something, and it's just it's not worth leaving for. But there's a second thing I would say to any young person really starting up: don't limit yourself in how long you think you can do the job. I mean, here am I, I'm still chasing around the place. I was in Afghanistan a month ago. at the age of 77. You know, don't limit yourself. Don't think that just because you pass a certain figure, you then cease to be of value. And I, you know, I just kind of keep on hoping it's
true. I'm sure that it is. Well, look, I mean, I have got one final question, but what I would say is that, you know, I think on behalf of all of us, we'll start petitioning the BBC to let you into Ukraine, because I certainly would love to hear your perspective on it. It would be fascinating. So my final question is an entirely selfish question, in fact. So anybody that knows me knows that I'm something of a geek about old aeroplanes. And I discovered by chance that your great grandfather, am I right, flew the first powered flight in Britain in 1908, a year after I think Blériot crossed the Channel. A year before Blériot crossed the Channel. Oh, thank you. Did legends about him feature significantly in your childhood, or, you know, do you think there's some connection? Oh, do you think some of your kind of spirit has come from him?
Well, what a lovely question to ask. Thank you. I was brought up in the sort of afterglow of Colonel Cody. He wasn't a colonel, and his name wasn't Cody. He was, to some extent, a con man, except where everything that mattered was concerned. So he came over to England. He was a brilliant rider and shot, absolutely brilliant marksman. Those were facts about him. And he built up a circus. He called himself Cody because of Buffalo Bill Cody. And he ran off with my great-grandmother, who was a married woman with no fewer than four kids living in Chelsea. And he went toured Europe with his circus. She used to stand against an iron screen, and he'd ride around on his horse, firing his gun at little glass balls all around her figure. Once he hit her in the thigh, and to kind of maintain his reputation for accurate marksmanship, she stood there until the act was finished. And he was absolutely magnificent, much older than all the other young guys that were flying pioneers. He was already in his late 40s, early 50s. The only way that he knew how to land was to crash. So every flight that he took, including his first one, ended in a near-death experience. Just a wonderful, fantastic, charming bloke. And then one day in 1913, he took a new model plane up, and it broke up in the air, and he died instantly. And I always felt something kind of went out of my family. A bit of the glamour and excitement and joy went out of my family when he died. But, you know, I was only born 30 odd years later, but everybody in the family was still talking about Cody, wow. Cody, Cody.
Wow, wow. Well, they do say that any landing you can walk away from is a good landing. So I'm sure that was true then. Well, John, it's absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. I've really, really enjoyed that, and I've learned a lot from it. And so thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. And I can't tell you how much of how chuffed I am that you would have noticed Cody and talked about him too.